13,000 precious children, and they were everyone's universe, as a Jewish sheikh says. So they were somebody's whole world and somebody's whole universe. And I just want to say to the kids, hi, I'm so proud of you. You have great ideas and a brilliant mind and a wonderful heart, and you're so kind, and you're welcome, and I adore you.
Rachel Griffin Accurso, known as Ms. Rachel to millions of children around the world who have watched her videos and listened to her songs. The Washington Post calls her the Mr. Rogers of her era. She has 16 million subscribers, more than 10 billion views, one of the most popular people on Netflix, and Tarek Hailat of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Thank you so much.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 88.7 FM WRHU Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert, and joining us in South Africa, Cape Town, is Mr. Kusi Veto of Bush Radio. Kusi, how are you today?
Awesome, awesome, Richard. It's been cold in South Africa, especially here in Cape Town, cold and wet. But at least today we see the sun, but we know that we can't be tricked by the sun, because as soon as you sit on it, you'll get a flu in the evening. So yeah, we're cautious, but at the same time, the weather is looking good in Cape Town.
Cautiously optimistic. So wait, when is it supposed to warm up again down there?
It's slowly coming into being, to actually going to our spring, which will be in September. And then the sun will come a little bit in, but obviously it's still going to rain up until maybe November. Then in November, that's where we have our proper summer.
Very nice. I'm sure you're looking forward to that, counting down the days. Am I right?
Definitely, man. Definitely.
Oh, good. Good. Well, we have a great show for you today. We're joined by Aviwe Funani from Unite for Global Mental Health. Aviwe, we thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation.
So for those who don't know, we pretty much just asked this in the beginning of every interview. What is Unite for Global Mental Health, and what is your role with the organization?
Thank you so much. My name is Aviwe Funani, and I am the Senior Policy Officer at United for Global Mental Health. My portfolio is focusing on children and youth. And as you asked about United for Global Mental Health, we are a global mental health policy organization, and we prioritize advocacy. And our work is mostly done through advocacy partnerships and evidence-based research. So what we do, an overview, is we help governments and donors understand the work around financing of mental health and its priority, as well as elevating the voices of people with lived experience. And then also we work to change and shape ecosystems to make sure that mental health is prioritized at a global and a national level.
But now, Aviwe, I know that mental health in the continent, especially in countries like South Africa, even though in South Africa, it's more aware of the global issues, thanks to access to information. But there used to be a stigma, you know, regarding mental health back in the days in South Africa, since we have a lot of different cultures, you know, there will be a sense of saying that if you are suffering from mental health and it's strong, is either you are bewitched, or there's some voodoo or spiritual things, to a point where people will be taken, you know, to traditional healers to get healed and all that. Is, as an organization, when you start observing and trying to educate, especially big companies or people that are involved in this, is that still there, especially on the ground?
I love this question so much because it is very much still a reality, and you'd be shocked or surprised that it's not only nuclear to South Africa. It is a challenge we face when we talk about health, and then you bring in mental health into that equation. A lot of times people are sadly unaware of what the reality of mental health is, or mental health advocacy. So first of all, we all have mental health, just like we all have physical health, we all have mental health. Obviously, just like any form of health, it does have a continuum. So there's a continuum of having good health, you're in good health, there's times when you're not experiencing good health. And it's the same with mental health. It is a continuum of We all have mental health, and at times that mental health is sometimes not in a good place, and sometimes it is in a great place. And that's the first way that we can really try and dissolve the stigma, by saying actually mental health is like physical health. It's just more about our neurological and emotional well-being. And then you're very right in terms of sometimes cultural stigmas, but it's also colonial inherited stigmas. So I know, being an African and being in South Africa, the conversation in many indigenous communities is that mental health is predominantly spiritual. And if there's any sign of mental ill health, then it is tagged as being whether demonized or bewitched. And then they're also supporting colonial laws that say if someone has a mental health condition or mental health illness, that they are not meant to be within communities. They you know, they're crazy, they're mad, they need to be locked away. So it really is, stigma is not something that is isolated to African communities. There's so much more behind it. But I'm glad that we are having the conversations like what we're having here with you today. It's really important. And for us to, you know, in kindness to each other's humanity, acknowledge that actually a lot of what sometimes we perpetuate as stigma are actually learned internalized biases that we just carry on without recognizing that actually we need education, we need awareness to actually help us navigate conversations. So yeah, the stigma is definitely there, but it is definitely linked to so many other things than just one group of people not having knowledge.
And Aviwe, you're a senior policy officer for children and youth programming with United for Global Mental Health. And it says on your site, 1 in 7 adolescents experience mental health issues, mm-hmm. and that the younger generation, at least where I am in the United States, is definitely mm-hmm. more proactive about speaking about mental health issues. But it says on the website, it appears all over the world. How do you approach it in South Africa? And just in general, dealing with child mm-hmm. and youth programming and addressing mental health issues versus mm-hmm. With adults?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I think because I work primarily focusing on children and youth, it's a really sad situation we find ourselves in that, you know, most mental health conditions start off by the age of 14. Also, that we're looking at a world that at the moment we have some of the youngest population in history, and going into 2030, that's actually one of the stats that is out there, that we have a young population. So if you're thinking the fact that most mental health conditions start off by like 14, that is most of the people that are living in this earth, and that within that population, unfortunately, you know, there are very high rates of depression and anxiety, and there's also quite a lot of loss of life to suicide, sadly, when we think about young people. And this is not just in like more developed countries. I know sometimes we make the mistake of thinking when we're talking about young people dying from suicide that this is, you know, a high income country issue, whereas we've seen it here, Kosi, in South Africa. It's become a rising issue in the past few years. And the situation is dire, but also a lot of young people aren't able to access mental health services because mental health itself is underfunded, but youth mental health is at the bottom of that scale. So for children and youth, they really fall between the cracks in terms of not getting any funding towards the cause of being able to prioritize prevention and promotion or access to care for young people experiencing mental health distress.
So now we're in the advantage, you know, of technology. Thanks to technology, for example, us, we're connecting from different parts of the world. How's the organization taking that advantage when it comes to using all these resources that are available out there for now, which who are free? So how's the organization using it?
I think one of the best things we have as an organization is that we are a global organization, and we have a lot of partners across the world. So we have what is called the Global Mental Health Action Network. That is a network or community of advocates that are about 7,000 across the world. And it's people working in different parts of the world and different levels of mental health advocacy, whether it's programs on the ground, whether it's policy change, whether it's financing mental health initiatives. So that's the first bit, just bringing together people from different parts of the world using online platforms. And for us, that platform is the Global Mental Health Action Network. We have a website for it. It's dmhan.org, and that's the Global Mental Health Action Network. So if you go onto that platform, you can access resources for different topics around mental health. There are different mental health working groups to help people who are, whether they're living with mental health conditions, whether they're advocating for mental health, whether they just want to learn. You can join that network. It's free of charge as a member, and then you can participate in the different working groups. And then there's also partners that we work with that actually use technology to create safe spaces for mental health sharing and learning and support groups. So for example, here in South Africa, there's the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, SADC, and they have one of the biggest helplines in Africa for people experiencing mental health distress, and they're able to redirect and signpost for support. But also we have partners such as SameSame, and they are an organization focusing on LGBTQI young people to be able to access care through the same app. And yeah, it's been exciting to see right now how, especially post-COVID, people have been able to tap into technology more than ever before. And we've seen communities be able to say, actually, we will take initiative and we will drive change. There's definitely still room for change at a policy level, but I definitely think there's a lot happening in terms of just community-led help desk, community-led helplines, meetings, call groups, working groups. So I definitely think people are putting in the initiative and they are reaching out to one another.
Considering that a lot of the work that you do is with children and youth, there is social media, like Kusi was saying, technology is a wonderful thing. But with social media, sometimes there's a lot of misinformation that goes out about mental health, about anything, but mental health too. And so people watching can be given wrong information, think, well, I should be doing this. When in reality, your organization has the resources of where they probably should be turning to. How do you combat that?
Yeah, what a time to be alive when you talk about that one. And you're right, social media is definitely a double-edged sword. Like it's really good in terms of, it's been able to help people create communities and networks and, you know, access help at the touch of a button. However, we're also finding, especially with younger generations, I always, you know, notice self-diagnosing as one of the biggest issues that I've picked up in the past 2 or 3 years, of where there's so much misinformation around particular mental health conditions, because, you know, I picked up this term and I feel a certain way today, so that's what I'm going to call myself today, that, you know, oh, I'm so, for example, I'm so bipolar, I'm so depressed. And there are people living with those psychiatric conditions, and they've been diagnosed by healthcare experts. But because the term is being used so lightly, whether it's TikTok challenges, there is misinformation that goes out through, you know, self-diagnosis. And I think we, at this point, you know, some people are saying, no, well, take away internet and take away apps and all this stuff. And as good and well that is, but at the end of the day, we do know that for a lot of people, technology has really brought in support and care. So how do we say we're going to take away something that we've seen the results in terms of it helping people and creating access? It's just about regulation, which is something at United we're talking about when we speak about technology, is how do we actually support the advocacy towards regulation of platforms, so that, number one, the mental health, not just of young people, but people's mental health is not compromised, that the language being used is also, you know, looked at and scrutinized a bit more, because mental health conditions exist doesn't mean if you're showing symptoms on a particular day that is what you have. And, you know, even online bullying, which I think is so sad and so horrible at the moment, and it's affecting so many young people around the world. You know, how do we regulate that? How do we create accountability? How do we protect young people? And also whether it's the language they get access to and platforms that they can access at what age? So it really is about how do we shift from saying, okay, we'll write this all off, but actually say there are good bits to these platforms that can help people. But how do we regulate that to make sure that as much as possible, we are trying to have child protection on those platforms, that we are protecting not just the young people, but people at large.
If you have just tuned in now, you're tuning in to the One World Community Radio Network, which is the first ever open source community radio network designed to connect broadcast stations around the world. Collaborators are invited to submit any content, you know, to this show and also be part of it. Again, my name is Kusi. Today, our guest is Uaviwe Funani, where we're speaking about mental health. So, Uaviwe, the issue now of mental health, you have to strategize, you have to plan. I know that your United's strategy for 2024 and 2026 outlines the vision for a world where mental health support is accessible to everyone, everywhere, without stigma. But now, another thing about the continent of Africa, as much as the world is moving fast, people are getting access to information, we can't deny that there are still a lot. I mean, 80% of places don't have access to internet, including South Africa. Internet is expensive. With the organization, you know, on pointing out certain policies and issues, do you guys also look in that?
Yeah, so definitely. That's one of the things in terms of how do you tackle different countries. And for us, if you look at our different pillars, there is a pillar around field building, which is where we're focusing on how do we amplify the voices of advocates. So we're not the only people speaking when it comes to mental health, and also that we're not speaking on behalf of thousands of people, but we're actually creating ecosystems for them to be able to share their stories, share their successes. And then we're doing that through the Global Mental Health Action Network, where we have different working groups, like I mentioned, and people can be part of this change. But what I really like about our strategy as an organization is that we also are really good at building partnerships. I think this is one of our greatest strengths as an organization, just understanding, you know, the power that comes with giving up power. And we push ourselves as an organization to truly just give up space so people can be able to share their stories, be able to share what works. We have got partners that are doing incredible work. For example, we've got partners in the Caribbean that just formed a coalition, so what is called the Caribbean Coalition, and it is focusing on advocating for mental health and the rights of people with mental health in the Caribbean. And this network has just happened so beautifully and organically through different organizations just coming together. And we've just had the opportunity of, you know, if it's been times where we've introduced partners to other partners, but they have felt such a sense of connectivity that they've gone on to build, you know, their own spaces. And it's really exciting to see how, if we, knowing what we know and having what we have in terms of resources, in terms of partners, we're just really intentional about how do we bring people together, how do we connect, you know, someone that's got a mental health program in a township, you know, in Soweto, with someone who works at the UNICEF office, for example. How do we bridge those gaps where someone who grew up in a village is like, well, I could never speak to someone who is part of the UN, the United Nations. But we say when we get invitations to be, you know, in certain spaces, where possible, we try our very best to actually give up space. So, for example, we took a few members of our network to New York earlier this year, building up to what is called the high-level meeting on non-communicable diseases and mental health that's going to be happening at the United Nations General Assembly in September. And leading up to that meeting in September, there's been quite a lot of negotiations, a lot of advocacy happening, and we've had the privilege of, you know, with our partners going to New York, and with the connections we have and relationships we've built with government missions in New York, we're able to just, you know, connect the dots in terms of, you know, we've got a young person from Zimbabwe. We have a relationship, for example, with the South African government mission, and they were able to meet. And it's been really great just watching how the power of, you know, giving up space, it can really change things. And from that, you know, governments are able to hear directly from people at a national level, what are the realities they're facing, so that when they go speak with other heads of states or leaders, that they have a lens that is comes from storytelling. And then also for these advocates coming from national organizations, that they can say, actually, we have learned this from other advocates working across the world. So I know I've dragged it a little bit, but just the power of convening and giving up power. So for us, that's how we aim to reach our mission as an organization.
What you were saying with bringing people to the United Nations and partnerships and even government partners and bring people to go and speak and share their stories. Yes. How do you kind of build a community network where you have all these partnerships and you can get people who ordinarily might not be in front of the United Nations General Assembly to go and speak? How do you build that to expand the conversation?
I love that question. I think also because I've worked in community organizations, you know, when you meet partners like at United for Global Mental Health that are really intentional about carving out space for people who are working in communities, it just changes the game so much. So like I said, we do quite a lot of work in terms of engaging with national partners that are doing work in mental health. So, for example, when I was working in programs in the Cape Flats that focus on youth mental health, you know, we became connected to United for Global Mental Health through a mutual partner organization. And they were like, should be part of this community. There are other advocates, and through, you know, the Global Mental Health Action Network, were exposed to other advocates that are working in mental health that were either even in Cape Town that we had never heard of or never met, and we built relationships. But that also, you know, it wasn't just a plus for us as a community-based organization, but also for United for Global Mental Health. We really treasure those relationships because it allows us to learn more. And as an organization, we really prioritize listening to understand what is happening at a national level instead of just prescribing what we think partners should do. We take a lot of time to learn and understand what partners are doing and integrate that into our policy work and integrate that into our advocacy work. And also where partners, you know, for example, want to write, let's say, a policy brief, and they come to us and they say, we're not really accustomed to writing a policy brief. Can you share examples with us? You know, we have all those resources on our websites that people can take a look at. And even when it comes to communicating advocacy successes or advocacy changes that you want, we have examples of those resources on the website. But we're constantly, as an organization, just like positioning ourselves to listen, positioning ourselves, you know, what are our partners saying? What are they saying is a priority? We learn quite a lot from them, and we take that and integrate it into our work. But what we learn also from, whether it's working with the UN and other partners, we don't just hold that information for ourselves. We usually repackage it and we share it with our partners so they can use it within their own context.
That is Aviwe. So Aviwe, obviously, with policymaking, there have to be meetings, there have to be processes. But now, besides that part, have you guys been affected? I know that with the likes of big donor like the US, who've been funding a lot of organizations all over the world where the President Donald Trump had to, you know, saying that this is too much spending for the country. Did it affect your organization, United for Global Mental Health?
Well, it is. It definitely affected all of us, I think, in different levels. And yeah, so we have quite a lot of partners that have been directly impacted. But as an organization, we've also put together resources to support, you know, different advocates in terms of the conversations around what is happening with funding. It is a time of uncertainty. So if you do want to, you can go on our website. We've put together, there's a resource that we have shared with the Global Mental Health Action Network and the Mental Health Innovation Network that is just talking around like the uncertainty that has come with funding cuts. And we've written a brief on it in terms of, you know, the realities that countries are facing, the realities that organizations are facing, but also how people can take some of the statistics and the information that is on that website and use that in terms of their own advocacy. I think at a time like this, it's very important for us to always keep at the back of our minds the power of connecting and staying connected. And then also being able to understand like what is really out there instead of hearing from this person or that person and making assumptions. I definitely would love to like redirect people to the Global Mental Health Action Network's website. And then you can find it under resources around the impacts of funding cuts. And just being able to hear stories from partner organizations and the impact on the ground, but also us saying, you know, we really encourage community in such a time and that we hope that the Global Mental Health Action Network will be that community space where people can still feel they can come, they can learn, they can share.
And on the topic of financing things, you had mentioned on the website that funding for mental health is usually about 2% of a national health budget for a country. Mm-hmm. And so how do you convince people, like Kusi was saying, about funding in the country? Oh, this is too much spending. That's too much spending. How do you convince the people, the lawmakers and the people with power that no, this requires a lot of spending? Because that's usually the last thing. We could do resources. We could do this. But spending and putting real money into something is usually the last thing governments want to do. How do you get them to do that?
Well, I think in most cases, we don't yet say we get them to do it. So it's more about, again, like going back to relationships. How do we leverage the relationships that we have to be able to, you know, constantly advocate for a matter? And I think when it comes to mental health, a lot of times people don't understand, like, an additional thing that I must fund. Why does this matter? Why now? But I think the most important thing we need to first understand is, you know, when we're talking about financing mental health, we are in a way upholding the human rights of people, and we're prioritizing their livelihoods and keeping in mind that if we are investing in the livelihoods of people, their mental health, their well-being, then we are in essence financing and investing into our futures. So that's the one bit. And then there's also the bit around understanding, you know, when we don't finance mental health, what exactly, what is it that is happening? What impact does it have? What ripple effect does it have? Whether it's on jobs, whether it's on schools, whether it's the workforce. There's quite a lot that we need to unpack. And I think one of the greatest ways I have started to look at advocating and talking about financing is understanding that when we speak about money and people, that in essence, you know, we're talking about investing in a person. So a lot of our advocacy when we're talking about increasing financing, we are saying that, you know, there's a little bit that is going into financing, and it's not yet enough. However, if we change the lens and we look at, you know, financing, what does that actually mean? At the moment, that domestic spending on mental health, it is very low. But if we're speaking and engaging with financiers, whether it's regional banks, global banks, or whether it's governments, it's just us saying, you know, we are looking at people. And I know for governments, for banks, they prioritize people as well. People are part of the societies. They build all these systems that we exist within, like this ecosystem of humanity exists within the system that is constantly being financed, you know? And so it's really important for us to know that when we are talking about advocating for mental health, that it is more than just about money. It is about improving the livelihood of people, improving the changes we want to reach in terms of upholding the human rights of people, able to, you know, make changes for different demographics and people. So I think the bigger picture is more about, if you're financing mental health, you're actually financing your future, you're financing your people, and also you're building into the economy of your country and also of the world generally.
Again, still tuning in on One World Radio. We're speaking to the United for Global Mental Health, and we're speaking to Uaviwe, highlighting some of the issues that they are focusing on as an organization. So now, Uaviwe, our listeners who are tuning in, we know that all over the world, in different communities, they're tuning in. But now, you know, as soon as you start speaking on policies that stages needs to be done, some people end up, you know, not really understanding it or moving back into it. What is the simplest way for the listener who's tuning in now, or maybe a granny there in the K-Flats who's listening to us as we speak, why these policies are important, you know, on mental health? And also, when it comes to funding the policies, is it making any difference for an ordinary person who's a DAO, who's in the street? We know that some people are suffering from mental health due to too much stress, unemployment. We know that in South Africa, crime is one of them. There's a whole lot of domestic abuse. There's a whole lot of things. But now when it comes to policy, at what impact do they do for somebody who's there in the ground, who's being affected hands on with the mental health?
Yeah, I love that question. I think especially because a lot of countries went into elections last year, this year. So I think there is a sense from people when it's election time, like, okay, I have a certain level of power in terms of decision making. And what are those decisions being made for? So first and foremost, these decisions are for you. You, your household, your livelihood. So when we're talking about policies, these are legal statements that can affect, in essence, what governments can or cannot do, if they agree to it. But also, it's saying, you know, we are partnering with organizations to say mental health is important because it will help us as South Africa, for example, be able to make change and create jobs, or understanding that within, when we're talking about gender-based violence in South Africa, I know there was a report that came out last year that actually tied the high level of domestic violence in South Africa to high levels of alcohol abuse and high levels of mental health stress. So, you know, when we're talking about policy, policies are not standalone things that are sitting there at some office with someone in a suit that we will never meet one day. Policies actually impact our day-to-day lives. So if people see that decision-making is based on policies, those are agreed to conversations or legislations that people either support or don't, but a lot of times we encourage people to advocate, because in that way, policies can reflect what it is that you want, what you need. And a lot of times, I know before I worked in policy, I used to be like, well, you know, is it really going to change anything? Does my, you know, speaking up or campaigning or voting, does that change anything in terms of a policy? Those are things for certain people with certain jobs, only to realize that actually, as society, one of our greatest powers is the power of coming together and advocating for what we see as solutions to the problems we face. And also advocating by highlighting some of the problems we face that other people might not get to see. So when we're saying we're advocating, we want to bring change to the table of decision makers, and they can actually look at what we're proposing and saying, actually, these people have a challenge. We didn't know people sitting in Delft in Cape Town, for example, are facing problem X, and this is what they're proposing we put into play in terms of how we'll make a change or how we'll improve the situation, and signing a policy into place that will be able to endorse what people are advocating for. And when there's policy in place, there's also opportunity for accountability. So you've got active citizenship, where citizens can say, there is a policy that says, you know, the mental health of people is a priority in South Africa and investment must be increased. With a policy, we'll be able to say, oh, our government committed to this, or our decision makers committed to this through this policy. And every time, you know, we want to hold our decision makers accountable, we'll say, well, there is a policy to back the solutions that we are proposing. So that's why we really encourage advocacy, because it does give you, it's not that you don't have power. I feel everyone has power. It's just a matter of how we use that power. And when people have that aha moment that actually your power has power. And I think advocacy is one of the ways that we put that power into play. And then, you know, it does go on to become a policy. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about that channel of change that comes through policy making.
And making it a people-focused issue is something I think that's been a main point through the whole interview. Something else the organization is doing that caught my eye on your website was the deinstitutionalization of people, and maybe saying that putting people with mental health issues, just putting them right in the institution, might not be the best path going forward, making more of a human rights issue. The same with, as we mentioned, suicide, which is one of the most horrible tragedies in our world, and that decriminalizing suicide, because making it a crime really hasn't stopped it. Sorry to say, tragically to say. Talk about how you really take the heavier topics and make it more human-centered and people-focused for the change that you've been advocating for.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up those points. And it's really important when we're talking about these heavy topics that our posture is really more about listening and not speaking on behalf of people who are going through particular experiences. And so I'll start around suicide prevention. So you already mentioned it, making suicide a crime, or people expressing that they're experiencing, you know, feelings of not necessarily wanting to be around anymore. And I'm saying this bearing in mind that it's a very sensitive and can be a triggering conversation. So I'm just trying to be as sensitive as possible in terms of how I articulate it. So firstly, it's understanding that when we are locking people away for a condition, a health condition that they're experiencing, immediately we understand that as, okay, that is very dehumanizing. And I think a lot of times when we take away the human aspect from things, it's easier for people to turn a blind eye. But when we're talking about, you know, suicide and we're talking about institutionalization, we understand that if we get to, you know, the crux of the matter, that these are people's lives, they're people behind all these numbers and solving these problems. People are not problems, they're experiencing problems, but they aren't problems. And when we're talking about upholding the rights of people with lived experience, and it's not only people with lived experience, it's even people whose families are experiencing mental health distress. So how we talk about mental health conditions and how we talk about people living with mental health conditions, the language around mental health is very critical. It's super important, because a lot of times we find that that is the make or break of someone being able to ask for help or be able to communicate when they're not feeling a certain way or communicate what they are feeling at a certain time. So rights is really something that is at the core of all of our work. I think, you know, we have our rights as a pillar in terms of the work that we're doing, but I definitely think as a mental health organization, human rights goes across everything that we're doing, whether it's in our ecosystem building, whether it's in mental health access and healthcare systems and field building. It all is about preserving and protecting the human rights of people with mental health conditions. And so we've put out different resources on our website. One is a report on deinstitutionalization, on what you just mentioned around, you know, the lens, or the fact that for a long time, I know personally, we've been taught that institutionalization of people with mental health conditions is the only way. When we're finding, you know, with examples like here in South Africa, we've had really, really sad cases of people who've lost their lives, whose human rights were taken away by being in institutions. And that is not to badmouth, you know, institutions or care that is for people living with mental health conditions, but it's saying that with a broader lens, there's an understanding that people actually, there's so many different ways of supporting people living with mental health conditions than othering them. And if we can increase financing for people with mental health conditions to be able to access care, whether it's when they go for their doctor's visits through primary health care, whether it's investing in prevention and promotion in communities, whether it's investing in awareness raising. This is all really important in terms of being able to protect people's human rights without dehumanizing them in the process. I think is something that we really, really need to understand as it being super important, and also takes away the shame and the stigma from people. And I guess, like, if we look at mental health as a fundamental human right, then it changes anything. And I think if anything that you take away from today's conversation is that mental health is a fundamental human right, and in every part of society or governance or advocacy, that if we look at mental health through that lens, then we will begin to really be more reflective on how we tackle certain issues, on how we engage people living with mental health conditions, on how we engage their family members, on whether we're creating responses that actually are not further creating wounds, but are actually creating safe spaces for people, and people feel heard. So that's one thing I really believe it's important for us when we're talking about deinstitutionalizing mental health care.
We're speaking to Aviwe Funani from Global Mental Health. So Aviwe, I hear you highlighted some of the issues that are happening, or especially when it comes to, I know you emphasize on funding, because in a nutshell, or in true reality, is that organization won't be going if there's no funding. So now, coming back, because I love touching more into what's happening on the ground, you know, in the streets, ordinary person that's listening, maybe they're in a taxi or in a bus, but what are the early detection of mental health?
Thank you for that question. And yeah, as a disclaimer, I am no health practitioner, so I will not be able to say this is a definitive in terms of what someone experiencing mental health distress looks like. I think that is also very individual. You know, people are unique. They experience different things, and certain situations are triggered by something different. So firstly, when we're speaking again around like the topic of mental health, is going back to what I'd opened with, and that is understanding that we all have mental health. So number one, just like if you've got a cold, you know when you're feeling well, you know, and then suddenly your back is hurting, you have a fever, all those things, those are symptoms of something. And it's the same with mental ill health. There are symptoms that, you know, you can identify, whether it's increasing isolation. Some people say feeling a sense of, you know, not belonging, feeling a sense of stress is a word used quite a lot. And I know from working with children, that's one of the words children would say, is like feeling a sense of stress or not knowing what to do, or feeling like you're cornered. So there are different feelings, and I, like I said, I can't be prescriptive because we all respond differently to different situations. However, I will say from a preventative lens that there are particular things that can increase your chances of experiencing mental health distress, and one of those things is experiencing trauma. And being exposed to trauma. And we know that trauma is in different ways. It can be from violence to poverty. That is all trauma. And the threshold at which we as human beings, you know, can cope, there are certain levels for each of us. But I think if you know someone that is in a situation that is exposing them to trauma, I would say, even if they haven't vocalized that they're feeling whether sad or they're feeling, you know, tired or they don't want to go out and do things, that it is a good place to start in terms of just engaging them and creating a space for them to communicate their feelings without being judged. And sometimes it takes also not feeling like you have to have the solutions, because I think that's something we do. As human beings, we want to save the day and we want to have solutions. But I think it's really important for us to become acquainted with, actually, within our communities, who are the social workers we can direct people to? Are there places online that can be of support to a friend, a family member, a coworker, when you do notice that actually this person is going through something? And whether they communicate it or don't communicate it, it really is, again, going back to the base of humanity and just being there for another person. And more than anything, being there to listen and not to judge and not to prescribe, but just being there to listen. Because I think all of us want to be heard to a certain level as people. We all long to be heard and to be understood.
And Aviwe, I know this is a very heavy topic. We've had a lot of difficult discussions, but yeah. What would you say is, in your experience with the organization, through the advocacy that you all done, what are some stories of hope that you could leave our listeners with?
Oh, there's so many. I think one is what I mentioned earlier, the Caribbean Coalition, that has honestly come together so beautifully and organically with our partners in the Caribbean that are advocating for mental health rights through suicide decriminalization, suicide prevention. We have had stories of our partners in Ghana, for example, that were advocating for so many years for the mental health bill in Ghana to be changed, and that was changed early last year, 2023. We have had an increase of partners that are actually, you know, being able to participate at a global level and have an understanding of what is it that is going on when it comes to their own human rights and mental health. So, for example, we had our partners in Brazil put together a policy paper for the mental health rights of children during the G20 processes in Brazil last year. So for me, I think some of our greatest successes is when we've had our partners at a national level just continue to drive change. And I think that for me is the greatest evidence of impact, is when, you know, people just catch it and they realize like how much power they have to bring change, and they come together. And that has been so inspiring to me, you know, just being able to hear these stories of hope and being able, I think even having more conversations like this, that we have more radio stations, more platforms, media wanting to have these conversations in terms of just like, how to do better, how can we create awareness. I think for me, these are the literal stories of impact that we look at and that leave us feeling really inspired.
Unfortunately, Aviwe, time is jealous of us being in this conversation. Before I let you go, though, any programs that you guys are busy with, projects, just quick, 1 minute or on that.
So I would encourage all our listeners to please join our Mental Health Action Network. So that's the Global Mental Health Action Network. It is, like I said, the network that has about 7,000 members from across the world. You can join different working groups. It'll help you increase your vocabulary in terms of different ways of advocating and meeting other fellow advocates. So it is gmhan.org, the Global Mental Health Action Network. And there are loads of resources you can find on there. And please join a working group. It's free of charge, the membership to the network. Please do participate.
And on that note, Aviwe, we thank you very much for participating in our program today. Once again, for more information on the website and the work you all do, where can people turn?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And where can people turn to find out more information about United for Global Mental Health? What's the website again?
Oh, yes. For United for Global Mental Health is unitedgmh.org. That is unitedgmh.org, unitedgmh.org. Yeah, you can find us on LinkedIn, you can find us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook. So please do follow us.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. And we thank you very much for the work that you are doing, for coming on today. You've been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech, and Bush Radio 89.5 FM, the mother of community radio. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio Program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, 89.5 FM Bush Radio, the mother of community radio, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert. We have our new great co-host, enthusiastic co-host in Cape Town.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.